Tov. Today's shir is L'schus Yitzchak Yisrael ben Rachel Leah of Rafur Shleim Amit Hashem. Amachav Rav Shasagid of Tov Shach Oli Yisrael. Okay, so we just have to finish the footnote and then we finally arrived at chapter 6, which is really, I think the best chapter in the book. It's really, the chapter 6 is a Maseches Befnei Atzma. But let's finish the footnote, because there's an important point that we didn't get a chance to finish. So let's just review this footnote. At the end of chapter 5, what the Rav is speaking about is that in the covenantal community, the most fundamental condition for its existence is what? Mutual agreement, mutual assumption of duties, and the principle of free negotiation. That's the definition of a covenant. The definition of a covenant, like God showed Abraham when they first walked between the parts in Bris Ben Besorim, that's the deeper meaning, right? When you were a kid, you learn about Hashem made the bris with Avram and Bris Ben Besorim, and like you slice the animals into and walk between. And I remember as a kid, I'm like, seriously? Like, that's quite the gory scene, right? You have to slice animals and walk between them. But what does that mean? It means that when you're walking with two people between two halves of an animal, that we're one unit. That's what a covenant is. A covenant is to show that we are essentially one, and that's the whole thing, walking between the parts. That's what Bris Ben Abisar means. And therefore, the Rav says, by definition, a covenant means equality. There's no such thing as a covenant without equality. That's the very definition of the word. And so the Rav says that therefore in the covenantal faith community between Adam 2 and God, there has to be this concept of that both parties are entering into a mutually assumed relationship, and that's the community of Adam 2 with God, that then, as we're going to see later on, will bring about the true redemption, the cathartic redemptiveness, and finally his being able to pair up with Eve too. That's what we learned in chapter 5, yeah? But then in the footnote, the Rav asked the question that if we're saying the covenant with God is what? Is mutually assumed, then there's an equality. Then what's with the whole story we all know by the giving of the Torah at Sinai that Hashem picked the mountain over their heads? You know, in Israel, there's a concept, Kfiyat Datit. You know what Kfiyat Datit is? Kfiyat Datit is with the
marriage.
Well, that's an example, but the Chilonim are already screaming for about 70 years, is it now? What are we, 60 years? Kfiyat Datit means religious coercion, marriage and divorce, funerals, not having buses and Shabbos, right? Kfiyat Datit, that the Chilonim are screaming that the religious push them to be religious. Whether that's true or not, but one thing for sure, that Sinai was the ultimate Kfiyat Datit, the Rav is saying, is that Hashem picked the mountain up over our head, and in a very seemingly non-romantic way, he said to us, do you remember what God said when he picked the mountain over our head?
If not, this should be your burial place.
This is your burial place, right. So the Rav is asking, that doesn't quite seem to be a covenant. That does not, huh?
Choice.
Right, so that doesn't quite seem to be a covenant. We were forced into it. So how does that fit with what the Rav is saying in the chapter about it being a community? And then the Rav says that really this question is asked by the commentators, that we said Nasa v'Nishma. I mean, the question is essentially the same question that it says clearly in the text of the Torah in Exodus 24, that we responded Nasa v'Nishma. And there are many Gemaras extolling the virtue of our saying Nasa v'Nishma. So why b'chal did God need to pick the mountain over our head? So the Rav explains that according to Rashi, he answered, really the giving of our accepting the Torah was the day before, on the 5th of Sivan, we entered the covenant, and then the 6th day, he then picked the mountain over our heads for a reason we're going to explain today. And according to Nachmanides, even according to the Ramban, that differs with Rashi, but remember we spoke about this week, that according to the Ramban, that Exodus 24, when we said Nasa v'Nishma, was after the giving of the Torah, after the picking of the Torah of our heads. But the Rav says that that's only according to certain aspects of the covenant. But the original covenant, according to the Ramban, we said we entered into, if you look in Exodus 19, there are verses that already said we said Nasa, already in Exodus chapter 19. So the Rav already says that both according to Rashi and the Ramban, the picking of the mountain over our heads was later. Entering the covenant was first. How much of the covenant that Rashi and the Ramban differ? But the fact that there was an entering into the covenant by the Jewish people, by everyone voluntarily, with our own volition, with their own desire, That was earlier. That's Exodus 19. The picking of the mountain over the head was afterwards. Why is that necessary? He's going to get to here at this point now. Yeah?
I mean, maybe the rope deals with it, but that would make it worse.
Why?
Because if the covenant, if you enter into a covenant on day one, and on day two, someone forces you against your free will to accept something, that breaks the covenant.
So he's going to get to the... So again, I keep saying, the Rav is going to address. So then why, if according to the Rav, the covenant was mutually agreed upon, why did he need to pick the mountain overhead? That's everyone is asking. That's the Rav is going to say this at the end of the footnote.
No, but I'm saying, no matter what the reason is...
You're saying he's going to break the covenant. So let's see what the Rav says. The Rav knows that. The Rav's... you should know that is like the most fundamental question that everyone asks. Why, if he said Nasav Nishma, why pick the mountain over the head? Everyone talks about that. But you're saying with the Rav's knach of covenant, of community, right? Then seemingly the picking the mountain on the head negates that.
Right.
So he's going to speak about that at the very end of the footnote. So let's see.
You don't see a problem with the concept of a covenant with God? That how can we little people have a covenant, equal connection with God? There isn't. How can that be?
So if you remember, we spoke about it. We read last week chapter of the
I
text,
asked it last week.
And the Rav said it's a paradox. The words of the Rav is that it's a paradoxical experience of freedom, reciprocity, and equality in one's personal confrontation with God. It is a paradoxical experience because it is completely illogical. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense, and yet God makes room for it. Now, you remember he said at the end of the chapter, remember he says, we meet God in the covenantal community as a comrade and fellow member, but yet God appears as the leader, teacher, and shepherd. There is that dynamic that he's the teacher, leader, and shepherd, but God does make room for that community. And that's what the Rav was saying in this chapter, that is the nature of the covenant at Sinai. And therefore, you're right, it is an extremely revolutionary idea that Heschel, as we spoke about last week, Heschel bases his entire philosophy on. Heschel takes this idea, and in the prophets, and man is not alone, and God in search of man, he completely smashes what most people consider normal theology. Normal theology is that God is the boss and we're just the servants. And Judaism, Heschel says, and again, he's not making it up, Heschel, or the Rav, it's found in our sources, that God completely enters into a covenant. And there are rules. And like the Rav himself brings, the famous story in Bav Metzia, there are such rules that Rabbi Yeshua was able to stand on his feet. And when God said that the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua said to God, Leib Shemayim hi, which means you already gave the rules, you can't change the rules of the game. And there are many places in Torah that say that God is bound by the rules of the Torah and bound by the covenant as much as we are. So it's paradoxical, and it's interesting the what Jay just asked, the answer to that is going to be sort of what you're bothered by at the very end of the footnote, but it's definitely a paradoxical experience that we're like having this covenant with God, and yet we're completely astounded and overwhelmed by Him. And there is always going to be that antinomy. And that's part of being a Jew. Part of being a Jew is always being able to have an antinomy. Part of being able to Jew is to question God and then be subservient, which is a contradiction in terms. We question God and we're subservient. We're subjugated and yet we're commanded to be rulers of the world. It's always living with that tension, which the Rav hinted to also in the essay Catharsis. Spoke about the fact that a Jew is living this dialectic. And this is one of those dialectics where we're a shutev with God, we're a partnership with God, and you are completely nullified to Him.
Right. So I can see it more in catharsis that you can get to a certain point with God, but then you have to pull back, just like in everything else.
Right.
But you have to pull back, which is not equality. So there is I'll wait.
That is what he's saying here about God is still the leader and the shepherd. Mm-hmm. And there's another knach, which he's going to say at the end of the footnote, but yeah, there is always this back and forth. Mm-hmm. By the way, in Chassidus Sfarim, it says, this two-step dance of being a partnership and an equal, so to speak, with God, and then being completely subservient as a complete eved, a servant, in general, as Chassidus speaks about, that's the difference between davening and learning Torah. Mm-hmm. The Gemara in Gittin says, Man Malchei Rabbanon, that people that learn Torah are like kings. We wear God's crown when you learn Torah. When you learn Torah, you're balabas, you're like a ruler over the world. When you learn Torah, you have the power of Torah. And we when you learn Torah, you have to say, I think like this. I don't. In Torah, you're not allowed to be subservient. In Torah, if Rashi says something that doesn't make sense, there are certain times you have to, you know, you have to say, okay, Rashi was smarter than me, whatever, but you have to say, but I don't understand what he's saying. In Torah, you have to use your mind. In Tefillah, it's giving up, it's being subjugated. That's generally that thing. But let's see, let's finish the funnel. Let's see, what you're bothered by is going to be the answer to Jay's question. You'll see. Let's read from again, where this, in light of this, right? Remember in the middle of footnote, in light of this, the Talmudic saying? Everyone have it?
Yep.
In light of this, the Talmudic saying, Mikan Medera Balaraisa. Remember, the Gemara said, according to this, that Hashem picked the mountain over our heads, then seemingly we have an excuse not to have to keep Torah. And the Gemara's answer was, of course, what? Purim. B'mei HaChashverosh, in the days of HaChashverosh, we accepted the Torah. That's the Gemara's answer, right? But the Rav is saying, everyone, let's get the pilpul again. The Rav is saying, according to what I'm saying, that Rashi and the Ramban, everyone will agree that we entered into the covenant willingly, and the picking of the mountain over our heads was only, for whatever reason, a later thing. We entered the covenant willingly. So how could the Gemara say that the picking of the mountain over our heads is an excuse not to have to keep Torah? So the Rav says, in light of this Talmudic saying is puzzling. Inasmuch as coercion was applied only to the implementation and not to the assumption of the covenantal obligation. The force was only to the implementation, not the actual accepting it. So the Rav says, the answer is that, of course, to be sure, this phrase is not to be construed in its literal meaning. So the Rav is essentially answering, it doesn't mean literally, the Gemara doesn't mean to say, oh, we picked the mountain over our heads, we don't have to keep Torah. It doesn't mean it literally. Since no scholar, what's the proof the Rav says? What's the proof that even when the Gemara says that now we don't have to keep Torah, it's not literal? Since no scholar has ever questioned the validity of the Sinai covenant, even prior to its reaffirmation in the days of Mordechai and the other men of the Great Assembly to which the Talmud refers. You never find anyone actually taking this literally until Purim, until historically. When was Purim, by the way, historically?
Between the first and second bayis.
Between the two temples, right? Between the first and second commonwealth of temples, right? Now, what's the biggest proof that this Gemara's phrase is not to be taken literally? Why was the first temple destroyed? Because we didn't keep our end of the covenant. Now, according to this Gemara, we didn't have to keep the Torah at all during the whole first temple, which of course is not true. All the prophets, Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Yechezkel was later, but Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Hosea, all the prophets that came before the first destruction of the first temple kept saying over and over again that we have to keep our end of the bargain, what we accepted at Sinai. So of course the Gemara doesn't mean to say literally that we didn't have to keep the Torah. Yeah? Rather,
if there was someone who said that, well, if there was someone who's like, you know, because of that whole episode at Sinai, I know you guys, you Jews are a pretty rotten lot, you guys don't have to keep the Torah, that probably wouldn't have made it into the canon.
Say that again?
It wouldn't have made it into the canon if there was a prophet who's like, well, you guys aren't following the rules, but you know what, you don't have to.
Well, it did make it into the canon. The Talmud. That's what they're ever saying. There is a sentence like that in the Talmud.
Okay.
The sentence in the Talmud is saying, well, we have an excuse, we were forced. So the Rav is saying nobody's taking that literally because there's nobody that ever questioned the validity of the Sinai covenant. But what does that sentence in the canon mean? That's exactly what the Rav is bothered by. So that's what he's going to explain now.
Do you take this mountain literally?
That he picked the mountain over our head? So I don't want to step in that because then Jay and I are going to fight for half hour. But it's an issue that's been debated already for a couple of...
distributively, then this whole discussion really doesn't matter.
I get it. So the whole idea of Agadata and the Gemara is a debate that's been waged for over... What's the term for 1,000 years?
Millennium.
A millennium. Over a millennium, yeah. Right? Whether Agadata is be taken willingly. So let's not go there. Okay. But one way or the other, everyone agrees that the idea conveyed by it is true.
Okay.
Let's see inside.
Why do they have to do it again?
What?
Why do they have to reenact...
So let's see what the Rav is going to answer.
That wasn't coerced.
Well, so whatever the Rav is going to answer to why we needed the mountain over our heads, right?
Right.
Let me say better. I'm sorry. Whatever the Rav is going to answer to what that sentence means was negated by the Purim miracle. So let's see how the Rav is going to explain. Look what he says. So what does that sentence mean? What does the Gemara mean that we mikan meder rabba laraisa? Says the Rav. The idea underlying this phrase, that now we don't have to keep Torah because he picked the mountain of our heads, is not literal, but rather is to be understood as referring to a moral mitigating circumstance rather than a juridic halachic defense. Newt, you're the lawyer. What's the Rav saying here? What do you think? The idea underlying this phrase, it doesn't mean literally we didn't have to keep the Torah. It's to be understood as referring to a moral mitigating circumstance rather than a juridic halachic defense. Does everyone know in law what a mitigating argument is?
Yeah, it means you're guilty, but it's, you know, you should still take into account this mitigating circumstance.
Exactly. A mitigating circumstance doesn't mean that shura sadin, letter of the law, you're not guilty. No, you're guilty. But we take into consideration mitigating circumstances means circumstances that sort of make that the punishment shouldn't be as much, right? And we find there were experts in our history of people that use mitigating arguments. You know, give me examples of tzaddikim that we had that used mitigating arguments against God. That really, that no, it's not that literally we're not chayiv. It's not a juridic halachic defense. It's a mitigating argument. My favorite
Yonah.
Example, huh?
Yonah.
That what? Yonah?
He didn't want to go to Nineveh because it would shed bad light on Israel.
So that's the opposite. There he didn't want it to be a what's the opposite of mitigating? A damning? There must be a better legal word than a damning thing. But who was an expert of a mitigating?
Well, Avraham arguing with Hashem about not destroying the rest of the world. Because, no, he was saying if there were 10... then that kind of mitigates the others.
Okay, that's mitigating.
Not exactly.
Right, so that the 10 mitigates thing. The Rabbim. What are you saying?
It sounds like Moshe's doing that through his whole career.
That's right. Moshe Rabbeinu was an expert lawyer.
Okay.
You remember any examples? There's one of my favorites of all time, which I mamish think, with this argument that Moshe Rabbeinu said, is going, when Mashiach comes, is going to get the entire generation off the hook from being punished for most of their sins. Mamish, you keep it in mind when you after Mitzvah Shem, if Chas V'Shalom Mashiach doesn't come after 120, remember this idea. When you get up to 120, Moshe Rabbeinu said, it's in the beginning of Sefer Devarim. You remember the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, Moshe Rabbeinu starts recounting all the different places and all the sins that we did. And when he refers to the doing of the golden calf, the name of the city he refers to it is Dizahav. And Rashi says there's no place called Dizahav. So you remember what Rashi says? Beautiful words. That Moshe Rabbeinu, what does Dai Zahav mean in Hebrew?
Too much gold.
Too much gold. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, imagine a father that takes his son, gives him a good shower, puts in him a nice cologne, takes a pouch of money around his neck, puts him on a door of prostitutes. Right? So what's the words? Remember what the words are? Mayasa ben veloyechta. What should the son do that he shouldn't sin? What do you want from him? The father washed him up, put him on him a nice cologne, put a money on his neck, put him on the door of the prostitutes. Of course he's going to sin. So Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, you God gave him so much gold, what do you expect of them not to make a golden calf? Whatever that means, because we don't know what it means to worship idols. But that mitigating argument is my all-time favorite. In this generation, if the Mayasa ben Velayechta, that's the words of Moshe Rabbeinu. What should the son do and not sin? If you put in front of him all these things, what do you expect of him? So after 120 mitzvah Hashem, you remember when Hashem asks, you say, Hashem, you gave us iPhones, you know, to 100, you know, I always say 50, you know, 100 years ago when our great-grandparents wanted to do a sin, they had to plan like 3 weeks before.
You had to work on it.
You had to mamish plan. You had to get a ticket to the big city. You had to save up money. It was like a whole thing, right? Today, you have an iPhone in your pocket. You could do all 365 sins with your iPhone. All of them, right? They're all by the press of a couple of buttons. So, Mayasa ben Velayechta. But that's an example of a mitigating argument. Or like the Berditchever says, you remember what the Berditchever? The Berditchever said one time, Erev Yom Kippur, he said, but Master of the Universe, you put all the punishments of Gehenna, you put in the book Reishis Chachma. You ever see Reishis Chachma? If you ever want to have nightmares, if you ever want you ever want to stay up at night and you've already seen all the Friday the 13th movies? Well, today they have new ones and stuff, but in my days it was Friday the 13th. So in Reishis Chachma, there's like 50 pages called Maseches Gehenna. He actually goes through all the Kabbalistic places of all the different types of torture in hell. Mamish like sounds like, you know, medieval. So the Ditchever says, you put all the things of Gehenna and Reishis Chachma in a book. And the Taivas of this world you put in front of our eyes. If you would have put the Taivas in a book and Gehenim in front of her eyes, then nobody would sin, right? So that's, again, that's a mitigating argument. So the Rav is essentially saying, it's not that that sentence necessarily means we didn't have to keep the Torah, because we did accept the covenant. That's what the Rav is saying, we accepted the covenant. That sentence is simply a mitigating argument that's saying, but we were forced into it. Oh. But now the question becomes in the next paragraph of the footnote. Now the Rav is bothered by what you were all asking. Why did he need it? Not just Tosfos said, everyone asks, why did God need to do it? If we accepted the covenant willingly, why did he need to put the mountain over our head? So look, it appears that God required two commitments on the part of the community. This is why he needed the two-step thing. A general one to abide by the will of God, while the community was still unaware of the nature of the commitment, and a specific one concerning each individual law. The second commitment was assumed under constraint. So here again, this is the Rav's answer. A general one, the first part of the commitment, which was the going into the covenant, the general one was to abide by the will of God while the community was still unaware of the nature of the commitment. And that one we did willingly. And a specific one concerning each individual law, and that second one was by constraint. Now that's a fascinating answer, no?
Do we have any other covenants that you have a two-step thing, like a covenant with Abraham or anybody else?
Well, Abraham, there were different, there was covenant over the land and the Bris Milah. There were other ones, but I don't know if it would be considered like a two-step like this. Right. Because here it's a general commitment, but that we are unaware of the nature of the commitment, and a second one, all the laws. You know what the best mashal for this is? Taka marriage. At least when you're getting married the first time. If you get married the second time, but the first time, when you go into the chuppah, you have no idea what it is you're getting into. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You have not the slightest idea what it is you're getting into. Your mom is going basically blindfolded. You think you know the person, you think you know what it means to be, you know, compromised, you think what it mean, you know what it means to live with the person, but you don't until you get married the first time. Second time you go into the chuppah, you're ready, you know, to be, you know, what's the, you're ready, you already know. You already know what it is you're signing up for, or maybe not.
I won't spoil it for you, but no, I don't think so.
So what the Rav is saying in the Purim story...
Well, I'm only 8 months, so you have to... Yeah,
they
what
accepted
room?
The halacha.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
That's
oh.
Why they did it again.
Oh. So I was going to say in marriage, the general commitment, when you're unaware of the details of what it means, that you would do willingly, right? Mm-hmm. But what's the second? Well, why is this a good mashal? Now that you're married already, and now all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, she tells you, I'm expecting X, Y, and Z. Right, there are the specifics of the commitment, right? The specifics. She says certain things. He's now already what it means to live together. This point already, there's no, you have no choice. Like, and now you have a mountain over your head, right? That means the general commitment was made willingly. But after you're already married, now when it comes to having to assume responsibilities of living with this person all the time, the details of the commitment. That's under constraint. That already you're forced because you already went into the general thing. 1 second. So the Rav is saying, Nasiv and Ishma, when we accepted the covenantal community, that was willingly. The fact that now the details of the commitment, that's why God had to put the mountain over our heads. What do you say, Jay?
I understand what the Rav is saying.
Yeah.
But that's not a covenant then. In other words, if you're going to say that it's a business deal, then you can say it's a mekachtos. The details of the deal were not spelled out beforehand, and you both walk away. However, if you're saying that it's an ever-binding covenant, that means anything going forward has to have, the covenant has to have the ability that both sides can act in the same manner and form. So just like God can change the rules and say, hey, I forgot to tell you about these conditions, we can say, hey, God, guess what? I have my conditions too.
Okay, so it's a great question. So listen, that's why what you're asking about a business deal is, I think, that's why marriage is such a good mashal. I'll tell you why. In a business deal, you have a contract with all the stipulations before. And you have lawyers that make a lot of money kvetching on every line. And if there's anything that goes against any line in the contract, the whole thing could be considered null and void. Marriage is not like that. Marriage, when you go into the chuppah, when you enter this covenant with this person, you don't know all their mishigas.
But that's why there's an out.
What?
We're not the Catholic Church. That's why there's an out.
Okay, so...
So because that's why I preface it by saying an ever-binding covenant. If something is ever-binding, which is not like marriage and not like a business deal, it has to hold true for all members of the covenant.
So you're saying a covenant can never be mutually dissolved?
No, that's
mutually,
our premise.
Mutually.
Yes. No.
It can't.
Mutually, not unilaterally.
But, Ellie, this is what I'm saying. We're going under the assumption that the covenant between us and God is ever-binding. That's the assumption.
Isn't that the assumption with marriage, too?
No. We have divorce.
We have divorce. But the assumption is that you're going into it forever.
No, but there's always an out.
He's defining covenant. I don't know if that's the right definition.
No, say that we don't have
a divorce?
We can't break away from God.
That's the definition of our covenant.
So I want to tell you something fascinating. You ready for this? And you should know, Jonathan Kaplan mentioned this, I think he mentioned it, if I'm not mistaken. And I said, we're going to get to it. Jonathan mentioned the Maharal. There's a famous Maharal. That the Maharal in Tiferes Yisrael, which is a sefer on Kabbalah Sotera, he asked this question, like everyone else, why did God have to pick the mountain overheads if he already said Nasa V'Nishma? And the Maharal's answer is, in order that it should be like the halacha by a rape victim. Who remembers, what's the halacha if a man rapes a woman?
You can't divorce her.
He could never divorce her. The pasuk says, V'loi siyeh le'isha, lay with a vav, V'loi tiyeh le'isha. She will be from a wife. La yucha l'shalcha kol yomav. He can never divorce her ever. So the Maharal says God, quote unquote, raped us to put in a situation where now he can never divorce us.
We can walk away.
But we can't divorce him. We could try to be like Yonah, but we really can't divorce him. We can't. And that's the hope that the Maharal is saying, that this is, in this detail, that it's not like a marriage. In this way, it's not like a marriage. That this is a covenant, this is a type of marriage that can never be dissolved. So we're using the mushal of marriage to say that the... Let me say it like this. Let me go back to what I was going to say before. You know, let me ask you, why is it in a business deal, why in a business shutfus, in a business partnership, why do you think it is that every condition is spelled out, and if it's broken, then we're not partners anymore. And in a marriage, all the conditions are not spelled out. I mean, the obvious answer is because pragmatically, you can't know the person's mishigas until you live with them. You never know a person until you live with them. That's for sure, right? But other than the fact that that pragmatic difference, why do you think philosophically? Why do you think a business partnership is spelled out all the details before, and a marriage is not? The answer is because in a business partnership, the whole reason for the partnership is, well, money or utilitarian, pragmatic. You scratch my back, I scratch my back. We're mutually using each other. My whole relationship with you is only for a purpose. I don't care about you. Our partnership is based on a joint enterprise. A marriage partnership is a different type of thing. I'm not entering with you into a marriage, even though some people do, but usually you don't enter a marriage because we're trying to accomplish an enterprise. I'm marrying you because I want you. And as we've been learning, the whole point of a real covenant is a connection of essence to essence. We're one unit, we're one thing now. And so therefore, even though I don't know your mishigas and I don't know the details won't matter. Or like the details are secondary, or the details are something we will now be forced to live with. That's what the Rav is saying. Once you have a general covenant and a commitment, that the point of this covenant is not utilitarian, the point of this covenant is an essential bond, then the second step, which is the details of the commitment, you're quote-unquote forced. That's what the Rav is saying, and it means the mountain is held over your head. Once you decide, you pledge under a chuppah, you're going to love this person forever, you have to feel that a mountain is being held. Now the details are forced upon you. Because this is your person. This is your person. This is the person you become. You're becoming one with. And now the details of the covenant, what it means in daily life, the fact that you're not going to ever be able to have sushi because it makes her, you know, disgusted, or, you know, all the details and stuff that you didn't know beforehand, those things are forced over your head like a mountain. Because this relationship is not based on practical. It's based on deep commitment of one person to the other. That's a real covenant. A business partnership is not a covenant. That's the difference between a partnership and a covenant. That's exactly the definition of the word. Covenant versus partnership. Partnership means we have a reason, we have an enterprise, and if you break any detail, we have to know all the details. Covenant is not a partnership. It's a much deeper thing.
I'll just reiterate it once, and then we can go on. That would mean that how we describe this covenant according to the Rav is how the Catholic Church describes marriage.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what the Maharal is saying.
And that's not what we believe.
No, but the Maharal is saying that in this marriage...
I understand what the Maharal is saying, mm-hmm. but that's not what we believe. He has formed a construct to fit into, to back into what he believes the covenant should mean. But that's not what we believe. Because we don't...
Between us and God, or between a man and a woman?
Between man and a woman.
So you're right, 100%. One said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Again, that's why he says the Maharal is saying specifically a man that rapes a woman.
I understand. So what I'm saying is, if he's defining that relationship based on a construct that he came up with, because that's not a true marriage, because it's really one-sided, that a rape victim was meant to be protected in that case.
Right.
It's not a mutual covenant. It's really one-sided.
Right.
We're still faced with that same paradox.
So here's the thing. First of all, I want to give you a Mar Mokum. If you get a chance, Rabbi Weinberger, this past year by Slichas, the Drasha before Slichas, is all about this. He speaks about all the seeming contradictory statements about whether God gave us a get, didn't give us a get. There are all sorts of different statements, like the Tana d'Avileo seems to say that he gave us a get, and then there's a Navi Yishaya says, Aye get Christus Hashem Chem, where is your get? Yishaya says, well, I never divorced you. So there's a whole thing that, like, are we like a woman that's divorced, not divorced? So he gave a whole drush about that. So you could listen to that. But I just want to say again, you always have to remember, in all metaphors that we use to define, or not define, that's not the right word, to describe the relationship of an us and God, every metaphor, by definition, is going to be imperfect and incomplete. Because, I'll give you the next example, is God my father or my husband? Now, you remember the Chinatown with Jack Nicholson, that scene, sister, daughter. I mean, that's what it's like sometimes with God, right? What is it? Is he my God? Is he my father? Is he my husband? Is he my king? You know, it's like, what's going on over here, right? So the answer is, because every metaphor, by definition, is going to be incomplete, because it's God. So every metaphor, we take from it certain aspects of the metaphor. So what the Maharal is saying, and I believe that that's what the Rav means to say here also, I think that's what the Rav is saying, is that even though Shir HaShirim is full of it, and we always speak about us and God being in a marriage, and it's true, there are all the aspects of marriage apply, and it's a covenant, and that's what it means, the general commitment, etc. And we accepted the general commitment willingly. We got married to God willingly. But the Maharal is saying, and I believe that's what the Rav means to say, is that when it comes to this aspect that you're speaking about the fact that it can't be dissolved, here we're not talking about what Judaism says a regular marriage. Here we're using the example of a marriage that was entered as a rape victim. That's what he means, the second aspect.
One trait of it, that's all he's saying.
Huh?
It's just one trait of that marriage.
Yes, one trait of that.
It's not the rape part, it's the effect.
Yeah, well, he's saying that God raped us, but it's the effect that the second part, the second commitment that was assumed and construed was the specifics of each of the laws themselves. Now, by the way, you see the Rav in the footnote then goes on to say, see Tosfos Shabbos 88a, at the end, this next line.
Yeah.
Now, that Tosfos, you know, you remember what Tosfos answers in that question? Tosfos also asks, if they said Nasav and Ishma, why did God have to put the mountain over their heads? So Tosfos says, that one was for Tersha B'chsav, one was for Tersha Baal Peh. Or it was also the Medrash Tanchuma says, or Tosfos brings it from Tanchuma. But the Medrash says that Nasav and Ishma was for Tersha B'chsav, and the mountain overhead was for Tersha Baal Peh. I think it was actually Tanchuma. I'm pretty sure Tosfos brings it also. I think he says something about the fire, whatever. But definitely the Tanchuma says that Tersha B'Chsav and Tersha B'Alpeh, and I think that also could fit very much what the Rav is saying. Because Tersha B'Chsav is generally, again, there are a lot of laws in Tersha B'Chsav also, but you can't compare it to Tersha B'Alpeh. Tersha B'Chsav a lot more is emphasized the relationship. Tersha B'Alpeh is the nitty-gritty. But now we come to the very end of the footnote, and here we're going to get to what Lenny was asking, what you were asking, Jay, and what Lenny was bothered for also. Which, again, look what he says. Let's read it. The reason for introducing an element of coercion. So now there are, that's why we need it for the second step. We need it to be forced because that was for the details. That's ready to, once you're married, now when it comes to the commitment, the details of the commitment, that has to be under constraint. But look what the Rav says. Why was that necessary when it comes to God? The reason for introducing an element of coercion into the Great Sinai Covenant, in contrast distinction to the biblical story, lies in the idea that covenantal man feels overpowered and defeated by God, even when he appears to be a free agent of his own will. That's incredible. You know why we need it to be coerced? Why did Chazal say with the coercion? Because covenantal man feels overpowered and defeated by God even when he appears to be a free agent of his own will.
It goes back to what the Rav said about Adam too.
That what? About being defeated and overpowered. Yes. What does he mean? But what does he mean? This is mamash paradoxical. This is like the paradoxical experience. The ultimate paradox. Are you an agent of free will or are you overpowered and defeated?
Well, you're being overpowered right there. By this mountain on top of
it. No, but that aspect. So the Rav is saying that the fact that the mountain over the head is representing that even though he's an agent of his free will, he at the same time he feels like an agent of free will, he's overpowered and defeated. That's the mountain represents him being overpowered and defeated, and that goes back to what you're asking if it's literal. Yeah. You should know, by the way, the Alter Rebbe explains in Torah Or, he says that in Chassidus that the mountain wasn't the literal mountain, at least according to that. Hasidic interpretation, but it was the overbearing love of God. His galus ahav el yoyna. God revealed this unbelievable love that he has for us, and that made us lose ourselves. But what do you think he means here? What does this mean, this being overpowered and defeated by God, even when he appears to be free of his own will? You know what that reminded me of? What's an example of a person that's overpowered and defeated, but he thinks he's a free agent of his free will? Somebody that's seduced. Think for a second. A person that's seduced, a person that's... You remember Sinatra's song, Witchcraft? Any Sinatra? Are you guys too young to be Sinatra fans?
Before my time.
Before your time? Nobody
it's
here?
Not before your time.
Nobody Sinatra? You're a Sinatra fan?
It's not before my time. It's not before your time.
So you remember Witchcraft?
Yes.
Remember the words?
No, but...
Proceed with what you're leading me to, remember? What's the words over there? The whole idea of the song is proceed with what you're leading me to, right? That witchcraft, wicked witchcraft, and although I know it's only taboo, when you arouse the need in me, anyway, the bottom line is that he's saying, proceed with what you're leading me to. It's witchcraft, what you're doing, but keep doing it, right? A person that's seduced, and this is also in Shir HaShirim, a person that's seduced thinks that they're a free agent of their own will, but they're overpowered and defeated. I'm not going to get graphic, but everyone knows that a person that's in such a situation is not thinking with their brain. Etc. Right?
Yeah.
Meaning that they might think that they're a free agent, but they're completely not. There's something that's completely overholding them. And that's what the Rav means, that's what it means that we were seduced by God. See, Lenny, that's what you were asking before, that it's paradoxical. You're right. It is paradoxical. Mm-hmm. But we feel we're a free agent, and we are. But there's something that's so that in this relationship with God, it's like, yeah, I'm a free agent. But it's like, I can't help myself.
But that gets back to catharsis.
That what?
Again, we're free agents, but we back away from that speck of blood, let's say. You know, we're seduced by our, catharsis, he talks about the bridegroom and the meeting with his...
Yeah, yeah.
And at that last moment, she says, no, we can't do it.
Right.
He backs away. So similarly... You know, he's almost seduced by her, but he has the strength to still have his free will of saying, no, I'm not going to continue.
Okay.
I'm going to stop. So, it is paradoxical. It'll be very hard. I mean, my whole, all our lives we're taught that God is all powerful, everything else. How can we ever be in equilibrium with that, with God?
So that's what he's saying. Again, it's a paradoxical experience. It is a paradoxical experience. If I would say to you, Lenny, are you supposed to feel that it's up to God to save the world or to you to save the world? What does Judaism say? Up to you. God put it in your hands. Mm-hmm. And that's the covenant. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the Rav is saying. That's what this whole chapter was about. That there is that paradox. He's not belittling the fact that it's but on the other hand, it's there that we also are told to have to be partners in that covenant.
But and we won't go into it because it's not in this context, but that raises bigger questions then.
Such as?
If we were seduced and it wasn't under our own free will.
Then how
can we have entered into a covenant under our own free will?
First of all, you could then ask in every marriage the same question.
Okay.
Second of all, so the answer is that's what the Rav is saying, that's the second, the introducing of this element of coercion as the second step. In other words, that is what the second step represents. The first step was that we went into it willingly. What the Rav is saying, why was it necessary to introduce the second step? What does it mean that he picked the mountain over heads? I don't know if he's hinting to the Alter Rebbe, but that's certainly what the Alter Rebbe says, that the mountain over heads was that he showed us how much he loves us, and then we couldn't hold ourselves back. Yeah? So I'm saying that it's not that the whole thing was the seduction. The second step was the seduction. Yeah.
In an Ari Kaplan essay, If You Were God, one of the bases there, that as soon as you meet God, if you see God, you lose your free will.
Right.
Because your life will be differently.
Right.
So the whole concept of free will and coercion and stuff like that, it's very confusing because, a month later they're building a Pesel.
Right.
At that moment in time, it's like you're saying that they're seduced. They can't think for themselves. It's overwhelming to the God degree.
Right. Well, I want to just say, I don't want to get too off topic, but when we speak about free will, Bechira, people, when they speak about losing free will, it sounds like, it's not that God, takes away from us, this magic thing called free will. He took away a power. What it means you lose free will means, if I would say to you, if you're standing in front of a huge bonfire, do you have free will to jump into the fire or not? You do have, you can, but if you're a normal, healthy person, that you don't jump in, you don't have free will. That's what it means. When a person, quote-unquote, does lose free will, or the angels don't have free will, it doesn't mean that they're robots. It means that, an angel is so aware of God that, that's what it means, it doesn't have free will. You don't have free will to jump into a bonfire. You don't have free will. You just can't jump in if you're healthy, right?
Right.
So when it means that God, that we lost free will, if you see God, you don't have free will. You know what that means?
No, every choice is clear.
Yeah. Right. It's not that we're a robot. So when
you know God, you know exactly what has to get done. You see it.
Oh, so that's why they were able to worship a calf a month later. Because when something is revealed to you not based on who you are, when that vision is gone, that's what it means that the free will comes back right away.
Okay, well, one of the things he says is that either have free will or your circuits get burnt out. Those are the two things.
Right, but you what I'm saying? Because losing free will just means that the truth is revealed to you,
right. And
it's not something that's coming from within, so therefore when that vision is taken away, that's what it means that all of a sudden they could worship the idol. So what the Rav is saying is that this second element was introduced. If our covenant with God was only based on that seduction, that's what the Gemara was saying, that it wouldn't be binding. But it's not. We had the initial acceptance.
Why did the Gemara have to come up with this whole idea, Kafal and Arpigius? What was the initial, I forgot the Gemara, but why did we even have to say that there was this?
Where does the Gemara learn it out from?
Yeah, why was
because the text says in Exodus 19, very strange words, that B'chodesh HaShlishi, they came to Midbar Sinai, and they came to Mount Sinai, and it says, Vayisyatzvu b'tachtis hahar. And they camped. Now, tachtis hahar is translated as at the foot of the mountain, but in Hebrew, what does tachtis hahar literally mean? Under the mountain. So that's what Chazal say, that that's the textual strange phraseology that leads us to say that Kafalim Harki, that we were literally under the mountain. Tov, chapter 6, shall we? Shall we dance? Now, as I said, chapter 6, you could read just chapter 6 without the rest of the book, and this is one of the classics in Jewish literature. This is the longest chapter in the book. It's a very long chapter. We're chapter 6 and 7 really together because they form one thing, chapter 6 and 7. But it's really, this is the meat and potatoes of the book. You don't need the rest of the book for chapter 6 and 7. Let's go. So, what do we say about Adam 2? We're understanding how the covenantal community is going to bring his cathartic redemptiveness, and we said in chapter 5 that Adam, too, enters a covenant with God. He enters a covenant with God, a covenant that cuts down to his very deepest part of who he is. Says the Rav, even though, as we said before, the man of faith is provoked, like Adam the first, by the cosmos, about which he is inquisitive, the covenant, not the cosmos, provides him with an answer to his questions. Now, you remember, he said this earlier, that they're both provoked by the cosmos. The world makes both of them. He already said. I can't find it offhand now. I lost the thing. But anyway, so both of them are provoked by the cosmos. Both of them are curious by the world itself. Just like Adam the first, Adam too is also provoked by the cosmos, by the world. He also is inquisitive about the world. But for Adam too, the covenant, not the cosmos, provides him with an answer to his questions. Meaning what? Adam 1, what is Adam 1's life all about? Conquering the world. Right? He's interested in functioning in the world, majesty, grandeur of the world. That's how he's going to get his fulfillment. Adam, too, he's also fascinated by the world, 100%. But that's not where he's going to get the answer to his questions. I just want to, in order to appreciate this better, you remember when he says the different questions that they all ask? Look at the beginning of chapter 2. I don't want to spend too much time, but let's read it quickly again. Remember chapter 2? I think you, Lenny, have a different version.
Yeah.
But the chapter 2 that starts, Adam the second, like Adam the first.
Thank you.
You have it? You probably have the chapter 3, Lenny? Okay, everyone have it? You have it, Ruben?
Lenny, day 16.
Thank you.
Adam the second, like Adam the first, is also intrigued by the cosmos. Intellectual curiosity drives them both to confront courageously the tremendous mystery of being. However, while the cosmos provokes Adam the first to quest for power and control, thus making him ask the functional how question, Adam the second responds to the call of the cosmos by engaging in a different kind of cognitive gesture. You remember this? Right? Adam the second is also intrigued by the cosmos. Adam the first just says how. Adam the second is provoked by the world to ask different type of cognitive gesture. He does not ask a single functional question. Instead, his inquiry is of a metaphysical nature and a threefold one. He wants to know why is it, what is it, who is it? Right? You remember that? Let's skip to number 3, because this is what the Rav is going to pick up over here. See where it says 3, Adam the second keeps on wondering? It's on page 21 of my version. Adam the second keeps on wondering, who is he who trails me steadily, uninvited and unwanted, like an everlasting shadow, and vanishes into the recesses of the transcendence the very instant I turn around to confront this numinous, awesome, and mysterious he? Who is he who fills Adam with awe and bliss, humility, and a sense of greatness concurrently? Who is he who to Adam clings in passionate, all-consuming love, and from whom he flees in mortal fear and dread? Right? This is the who that Adam the second wants to know. So he's curious about the world, but he starts asking who. So let's go back now to where we're holding in chapter 6. And that's where the Rav is now picking up over here. So even though, as we said before, let's start again, Adam the second, the man of faith, meaning Adam second, is provoked like Adam one by the cosmos about which he's inquisitive, but it's the covenant, not the cosmos, provides him with an answer to his questions. Which questions? The three questions that Adam the second, that the Rav brought in chapter 2. Now, And now the Rav is going to explain how even though Adam, too, a man of faith, is fascinated by the world, but that's not what the relationship is about. And this now, what we're going to read here, as I said, is one of the most basic writings of the Rav. And I want to tell you, what he's now going to say in these sentences is one of the most fundamental things in Jewish, in the corpus of Jewish literature, that says what it means to be a Jew that has a relationship with God. What the Rav is going to say is that for a Jew, or any man of faith, a relationship with God is not based on him being master of the world, God of the world, creator of the world. The world is not the main place where we have a relationship with God. It's just the springboard. For Adam, too, the world is only the conduit through which he starts having a relationship with God, but then has to be something that transcends the world. My relationship with God is not based on whether I have a good salary. It's not based on whether my life is going well. God is not an ATM machine, like I always say. See, there are a lot of people that for them, my relationship with God is just a way for me to get what I need in my life. And then if things go wrong, then God doesn't work anymore. It's not that. It's a lot deeper than that. And that's what the Rav is going to say in his very eloquent way in these next sentences. Let's read. It's true that the covenantal confrontation is indispensable for the man of faith. For him, you need the covenantal confrontation, not just the cosmos, not just the world. In his longing for God, he is many a time disenchanted with the cosmic revelation and lives through moments of despair. He's not satisfied with the confrontation that happens in the world. He's not satisfied with just the beauty of the world. Naturally, he is inspired by the great joy. It's true, he is inspired by the great joy experienced when he gets a glimpse of the truly real hiding behind the magnificent cosmic facade. Of course, he sees a beautiful sunset, a beautiful ocean. What was the place you saw up north? What's it called?
The Northern Lights.
Huh? The Northern Lights. What's the fancy word for
Aurora
it?
Borealis.
Aurora Borealis. You see something like that, you get a glimpse of the truly real, capital truly real, right? Meaning God, hiding behind the magnificent cosmic facade. However, even though you see that beauty of the world, he is also tormented by the stress and exasperation felt when the truly real seems to disappear from the cosmic scene. Which in simple English means, let me ask you, when you're looking at the world, do you see God or not?
Depends what you're looking at.
Meaning, explain. You must see the most beautiful thing that there is in the world.
It also depends who the person is.
A man of faith.
Always sees God.
Always sees God in everything. But so when you look at the world, are you satisfied? But let's say, the man of faith, as he says, he gets joy from it, right? But sometimes you're also tormented by the world. Why? Why? If you see the most, again, we're talking about a person, not that seeing, you know, a rainy, disgusting Manhattan street with homeless people sleeping in the rain. When you're seeing the most beautiful things that the world has to offer, why would the man of faith also feel tormented sometimes?
Because he knows that's not total reality.
Why? Because God is way beyond this as well, right? That's the idea. If I would say to you, is the world God? Chas v'shalom, that's pantheism. The world is godliness. The world is the light, a ray of God's light. Creation of God, a ray of God's light, depending if you're speaking philosophically or Kabbalistically. But it's not God. God is way beyond that. And so therefore the lover of God is not content by just the world. That's why the Rav, in the other great book of the Rav, From There You Shall Seek, right? You know the book, From There You Shall Seek, from the Rav? You never saw that? You didn't read that? Wow. Mitzvah, I hope one day if we finish this, I'd love to do that. That's a book, the whole book is about Shir Shir. And the Rav speaks about the different, and you know, the Rav speaks about all these different levels in the relationship with God. And if you read Shir Shir, you see that like the lovers keep coming together. Like they meet each other in like the forest, in the field, or whatever. And then they run away from each other and separate. And it's like back and forth. It's like this whole game. Back and forth. And what the Rav explains there is what he's saying in these few sentences over here, he expands at great length over there, is that because in the relationship with God, you see the most beautiful sunset you can imagine. You're seeing the light of God. But all of a sudden you realize that he's way beyond that. It's only a faint ray of the light of Hashem. Look, let's read inside. Of course, God speaks through His works. Right? It's true. God does speak through His works. On one hand, God speaks through His works. We say every in Tehillim from Psalms 19, Hashemayim misapim kved kel. We say this in Shabbos, right? Shabbos, if you come early enough to shul, and you're not one of those that skip, then you say in Lamanetzech, that we say in Pesukah Dezimra on Shabbos, Hashemayim misapim kved kel. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth His handiwork. So the world speaks, God speaks through the world. But says the Rav, yet let me ask, what kind of a tale do the heavens tell? Is it a personal tale addressed to someone? Or is it a tale which is not intended for any audience? Let's sit with that question for a little. Is it a personal tale? When the Shamayim Resapim Kvayd Kel, when the heavens declare the glory of God, God is speaking through the world. What kind of tale is it? Is it a personal tale addressed to someone? Or is it a tale which is not intended for any audience? God is speaking through the world, but who's He talking to? Not me, seemingly. Not you, seemingly, right? What do you say, Steve?
Or only me.
Huh?
All of us. I mean, that's each individual. What,
the assumption is that the whole thing is a paradox, right? That contradictory nature is built into the fabric. And as you mentioned before, the religious, or let's say religious man, lives with that paradox. There is no solution. So it's the pull and the push.
Right. So that's what the Rav is saying, though. So he's elaborating on that exactly.
Right. But the thing of again, just along those lines. So you're saying, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, and what's the converse of that?
Offer of Afer.
Right.
So what does it mean? So what do you mean? Is that enough?
No, that is.
When you see the world and you see the beauty,
yeah.
You're saying, so how, you're viewing it from both sides, like it's nothing, it's everything?
You're seeing it, oh my God, look how beautiful this God is revealing Himself here. But then all of a sudden you're like, wait, but this isn't what God is, and who's He talking to? It's not even me over here.
Right, but
You get a glimpse of, again, using the metaphor that Takas Shir Shirim uses, you get a glimpse of your beloved, and you're like, and then she runs away.
It's a noise in the forest.
And you think, you know, she comes to the window, you get a glimpse, and she, like, sings. You remember the scene, you'll forgive me for using the reference or not, but you remember in Romeo and Juliet, when he comes to the beginning of the balcony scene? So he comes and he's standing on the balcony and he doesn't know that Juliet is sees him and she starts talking, right? What's the Lashon over there?
Feel free to quote.
But soft, what light from yonder window breaks? It is the east and Juliet is the sun, right? He sees all of a sudden and she's standing there and he sees this, he has this whole monologue where he sees the beauty of Juliet. And he's enraptured by her, and then she starts talking, but she's not talking to him. So over there, I mean, there's a nice ending. Well, at least at the balcony scene. Later on, it's not a nice ending. But the balcony scene ends up like a nice ending. They end up getting together, yeah? And they decide to get married the first time they meet. But we'll leave that. But in other times, when a person, let's say in Shir Shirim, he sees the beloved, and then she runs off. So there's this taunting. And the Rav is saying the man of faith feels that from the world. It's like God is revealing Himself, but then he's like running away. It's like, okay, yeah, God revealed Himself, but yet He's not talking to me. So like, yeah, I feel close to God, but then all of a sudden I realize, what do you mean? But God is infinitely above that. And that's what the Rav is going to say, that there's this. Let's read a little further. He's going to elaborate.
It's also interesting that he's calling God now the truly real.
With capital T and R, right? It's fascinating.
Because is that really real?
Huh?
What's the true? What's the real? Like, is God truly real?
Why do you keep saying truly real?
Yeah. It's an interesting way of.
Well, I think the reason he's saying truly real is because he's saying, look, both times he uses it. He says the truly real hiding behind the cosmic facade, and then the next sentence he says the truly real that disappears from the cosmic scene. I think what the Rav is referring to is that what Chassidus talks about, that when we speak about the light of God that is in the cosmos, in the world, is not the truth of God's being. It's only a ray from his being. That's what I was saying, not pantheism. In other words, it's very important. When Hasidus speaks about that the world is the light of Hashem, so a person that doesn't think too deep, or we could say that what the Vilna Gaon was afraid of, that he misunderstood what Hasidus was saying, is that if the world is God's light, so, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, indulge in hedonism, the world is godliness, why do I need to do a mitzvah? I could just, you know, like, remember Allen Ginsberg, holy, 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 table is holy, everything is holy, right? Remember how?
No.
Right? Everything is holy, 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 so what do I need God for? Right? The world is God. That's pantheism. That's what the Vilna Gaon was afraid of. But Hasidus explains why is it not like this, what the Rav is referring to. The world is not the truly real. And the mashal given, imagine your beloved is in jail. And she's trapped in jail for 40 years. And all that the guards let her stick out of the, like there's a little hole, she could stick her finger out of the hole. And you could touch her finger. So you would say, okay, so fine, I don't mind that my beloved is in jail, I'm able to touch her finger. When you touch her finger, will that make you feel satisfied? Or will it make you feel even more longing and yearning, right? Touching the finger will make you even feel more. You're looking for the truly real her that's beyond the cosmic facade. The truly real is Atzmos, is Ein Sof, is God's infinity. The world is only a ray of his light. It's only the name Elohim, as the Rav himself is going to say at the end of this chapter. The Rav himself is referring to these ideas. He's going to say that's only the name Elohim. It's only the contractile. It's only God's finger. The whole universe is only a finger of God. Not even, it's a hair from God. Right? So like imagine, that's exactly what the Rav is saying. Imagine holding your beloved's finger when she's trapped in a jail. That's going to make you feel even more yearning. So the man of faith looks at the world, but then yearns for the truly real that's beyond the cosmic facade. Let's read a little further. Do the heavens sing the glory of the Creator without troubling to themselves to find out whether someone is listening to this great song? I believe that the answer to this question is obvious. If the tale of the heavens was a personal one, addressed to man, then there would be no need for another encounter with God. Since God in his infinite wisdom arranged for the apocalyptic covenantal meeting with man, we may conclude the message of the heavens is at best an equivocal one. And I want to read a little further. We're going to come back to this next week, but I want to see this, that what I just said now, how the Rav says it, and we'll come back. As a matter of fact, let's read a little further, another few sentences. At the level of his cosmic confrontation with God, man is faced with an exasperating paradox. It's mamash like the mashal I gave you with the beloved sticking the finger out. Look, on the one end, do I see God in the world? On the one end, he beholds God in every nook and corner of creation, in the flowering of the plant, in the rushing of the tide, and in the movement of his own muscle, as if God were at hand, close to and beside him, and engaging him in a friendly dialogue. And yet the very moment man turns his face to God, touches the finger, he finds God remote, unapproachable, enveloped in transcendence and mystery. So I'm feeling God in my own muscle, in my own heartbeat. That's God in every nook and corner of creation. And yet when I turn to God, and I speak to God, Baruch Atah, is Shem Havaya, he's completely transcendent. That caused the man of faith to yearn for the covenant. So that's why for the man of faith, what's going to quench his thirst? Not a beautiful sunset. A blat gemara. A mitzvah. Because that's where the covenant is. For the man of faith, he needs a covenant with God. He needs to, the world is not going to quench his thirst for God. That's why you need Torah Mitzvahs. That's why you need the covenant. Okay. Continue with Hashem next week.
Next life.
I think in the Rav's philosophy, both here in an halachic man, and especially in Chassidus, we wouldn't say you have to wait for the next life. The covenant, you engage in the covenant in this world, in Torah Mitzvahs. We have that relationship.
Isn't that satisfying enough for the man of faith? That's enough?
I agree with you that the ultimate satisfaction will be, when you say next life, I mean, it depends what you mean. When Mashiach comes.
Right.
Yeah, that, yes.
And after Mashiach comes, after.
Right, the Messianic era will be the ultimate cathartic redemptiveness, yeah.
It's interesting the way the Rav presents it. It's as if where Adam 1 leaves off, Adam 2 begins.
Yeah.
Because Adam 1 is the paradigm of what's written about Alexander, that he despaired the moment he realized that there were no more worlds to conquer.
Right.
Yet that's where Adam 2 says there's always more worlds to conquer because right. It's from within, it's not from without.
Yep. Yep. Fine. Okay, Shkoyach. Could anyone tell me...